Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and once again we've got the most incredible guest to speak to today. I'm still struggling to comprehend that he is actually on the line with us, but before we introduce him, first of all, two co-pilots for this edition. First of all, Mr. Paul McParlan. Paul, welcome.
Hi, Stuart. I'm so looking forward to being a co-pilot on this voyage as well. It's going to be a fascinating hour. Really looking forward to it.
It is. It's going to be, it's just going to be sensational. I know it is. Second co-pilot, who was fashionably late, I just need that noted down, is Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Stu. How are we all doing?
Good. And this guest, a player that fits right into our era.
Oh, absolutely, definitely. You know, this child born of the 70s and, you know, growing up in the 80s, this is just like perfect. Yeah,
it is. So our guest today then is Mr. Gary Mabbutt, MBE.
That's it. Tottenham win the FA Cup. Brian Clough's long wait for the one trophy that's eluded him continues. Des Walker heading into his own net in extra time. And Spurs win the FA Cup for a record eighth time. Delight for Terry Venables and Doug Livermore. Game that started so badly with the loss of Paul Gascoigne and the concession of an early goal. Des Walker sinks to his knees. But delight for Spurs, particularly in the circumstances in which they managed to pull it off. And Gary Mabbutt will feel a great sense of retribution after what happened in 1987. He's dreamt of this moment. He takes the FA Cup, which has been won by Tottenham for a record eighth occasion. And after the despair of 1987.
Where'd you start? Gary's long, distinguished football career. Made his debut for the local side, Bristol Rovers, in 79 before moving to Tottenham in 82. Goes on to make 619 appearances, club captain for 11 years. Won the UEFA Cup in 84, FA Cup in 91. Played for England 16 occasions. Arguably, should have been more. We might get into that. 94, he was awarded an MBE for services to football. Called time in his career at the end of the 97-98 season. Then, since then, it's almost a new life has begun. Actively involved in football. Was an ambassador for the 2010 World Cup finals in South Africa. Worked with the Football Association on a number of projects. And then we get into the more interesting stuff. Actively involved in the Sporting Memories Foundation. Assisting people suffering from dementia. Most of you hopefully will have seen more recently, he's been calling vulnerable Spurs supporters who've been confined during this period of lockdown on special occasions, such as anniversaries, birthdays, as part of his role as club ambassador for Tottenham. Already made over 1,520 phone calls since March. And I kind of get that some actually struggle to believe that it's him. I'm struggling. Before we even chat to him today. Gary, I'm sure a lot of people are aware, diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at the age of 17. Told by doctors his condition meant he would not be able to play professional football, but was determined to prove the medics wrong, and did he? As his extensive and successful career at the top of the football is testament to. First player with type 1 diabetes to be capped by England, and has been a trailblazer ever since. He's the Vice President of Diabetes UK, active campaigner on their behalf. Inspiration, role model to young people who have been diagnosed with this lifelong condition and for which there's still no cure. One of his enduring missions is to ensure that everyone diagnosed with condition has access to the full range of medical support available. And as Paul mentioned, it's, you know, it is an absolute honour to have this guy with us today. We're going to discuss his time in the game, discuss his role with Diabetes UK. And he did say that he's got to leave just that little bit earlier before we chat about Tottenham's chance of lifting the title this season. Gary, thank you and welcome.
Hi, gents. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
We'll get straight into it because obviously, you know, time's precious. So I think if we start off with those very early days at Bristol Rovers, you know, way back, right at the very, very beginning of your career. And I guess football was just a different beast then.
Yes, obviously growing up, I grew up in a footballing family. My father was a footballer, played in the English 3rd and 4th divisions of Bristol Rovers in Newport County. And so, you know, football was always around us. I always wanted to be a professional footballer. I went to a grammar school in Bristol and I had to work very hard to get my... I got 5 O-levels in the end. In that era, they were called O-levels and you had to get 4 to go on to your A-levels. So I could have stayed on, done my A-levels and then university maybe. But then I was given the opportunity to have an apprenticeship in football with Bristol Rovers. So I accepted that and joined Bristol Rovers. And literally you know, had a wonderful apprenticeship. It was very different in those days. As an apprentice, you had to be out on the pitch in the afternoons, you know, clearing the pitch after a match, putting all the divots back. You had to paint the stadium during the summer. You had to clean the manager's car. So there's a lot of very different things you had to do. But it was a good apprenticeship I had. And during my time as a youth player at Bristol Rovers, I got in the England youth team, which was you know, obviously fantastic for myself. And I got in the Bristol Rovers first team when I was sort of 16, 17 years of age. And yeah, so I was playing in the first team was on a regular basis. And then obviously my diabetes came along. It was just after Christmas, 1978, when I was feeling very, very thirsty, going to the toilet all the time, drinking a lot. And I mentioned this to the club and they thought I'd obviously been out over Christmas and having a good time, which wasn't the case. We then played away at Leicester on New Year's Day and we lost 3-0. And I probably had the worst game I've ever had in football. At the end, I came off, the manager came and sat by me and said, look, Gary, you know, basically you were awful today. I'm dropping you for the next game. But obviously, you weren't yourself, what's up? And I explained to him the problem. So we arranged when we got back to Bristol that night to go and see the club doctor. And within 15 minutes, I was on my way to hospital, being diagnosed as a diabetic. Of course, then no one really knew what diabetes was. We're talking about 42 years ago. I knew it was something to do with injections and your blood sugars, but had no idea. Got to the hospital and told me then I had to be on injections for the rest of my life. So during that spell, I was on sort of 4 injections a day growing up. And of course, then it was a big concern about my career. I mean, the condition itself, I remember obviously you're not allowed to have, obviously then it was no sugar you're allowed, no sugary drinks, no chocolate sweets, etc. But no one knew about this. And my parents and my brother came to visit me. And my brother bought me 2 Shoot magazines and a box of Maltesers chocolates. So it didn't quite go down very well. We contacted some of the best specialists in the world on diabetes. And they said to us that the first 3 said, look, there's no way you'll be able to play professional football with this condition. Going to inject yourself, you know, obviously 4 times a day, blood testing, being able to play, you know, 2-3 matches a week, training 3 hours every day. The injuries, they said if you've got an injury, you wouldn't be able to get back from it because it would affect the recovery time. And so after the first 3 calls, these top specialists, it was a bit depressing. We spoke to a 4th gentleman and he said, look, Gary, no one's ever done it from such a young age, coming all the way through to be a professional footballer with diabetes. But if you're prepared to go for it, then I'll support you. And here we are. So I was back playing the Rovers first team within 2 months. And in the following year, my contract ran out. And it was just as sort of freedom of contract was starting to come in. But then you, at the end of your contract, you could write to any club you wanted to write to and say, look, I'm available. I played 140 games at Bristol Rovers. I scored 12 goals, played for the England youth team, blah, 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 and 21 team. and see if anyone was interested. So I wrote to all the First Division clubs, and I had two replies. One from Aston Villa saying, thank you for your letter. We're sorry we can't even give you a trial. Thank you very much. And one from Birmingham City, Ron Saunders. So I travelled up to Birmingham. Birmingham were a First Division team then. Met with Ron Saunders, showed me around the stadium. I was very impressed with everything. Explained to me where he wanted me to play. It was the Birmingham side. It has, you know, Mickey Harford at the time. It was that sort of a tough side. He wanted me to be in the centre of midfield. And I left Birmingham, and I was, you know, it was a First Division move for me. We were in the Third Division, Bristol Rovers, so it was my only option. And then the following morning, my phone rang at home. I picked the phone up and picked up the phone. I said, hello. He said, hello, is that Gary? I said, yes. Oh, this is Bill Nicholson from Spurs. And Bill said that, Gary, I've been watching you over the last 2 or 3 years. I believe you've got the ability to be a Spurs player. Do you want to come up and have a chat with me? So I drove up to London the following day. And it's weird because you will say things. You say, well, did that really happen? But I can remember driving through the gates, the old wrought iron gates of White Hart Lane. And driving through those gates, it just had the brand new West Stand that had just been built. And it just looked so impressive. And driving through those gates, I just felt like I was at home. It just felt like this is where I had to be. So I was then taken to the Spurs training ground with Bill Nicholson, took me up and went into the canteen where the players had finished training, were having their lunch. And for me, it was incredible because all the players I saw in front of me were all international stars. I'd only ever seen them before, you know, either on Match of the Day or on Top of the Pops. So it was a strange time for me. I met Keith Birkinshaw, the manager. And to be honest, I think, I'm not sure if Keith knew too much about me. He was just taking Bill's advice. And basically, Keith told me that. He said, look, Gary, you know, Bill has told me that he thinks you've got the potential to be a Spurs player. So I'm keen to sign you. And obviously, it may take you 2 or 3 years to get in the side. We'll work with you, which I was very happy with. And obviously, I had to have a special medical because of my condition. But I passed the medical. And signed for Spurs. And you know, as Keith said, well, Gary, you may be in the reserves for a couple of years, but you know, we've got great training facilities here, great coaches. As I said, I was pleased to sign because Spurs, to me, were one of the top teams in the world. So I signed in the end of July, middle of July, pre-season time. 2 weeks later, we were going on a tour, first team to Norway. And I went on the tour. Now, after the first couple of games, we had 3 or 4 injuries. And then Keith put me in the team for the third game in Norway. I stayed there for 16 years. So it was very, very strange, the turnaround from, you know, 1 month I was playing the Third Division Bristol Rovers, and then a month later I was playing for Spurs in the English First Division. So a big transformation in a short time.
Okay, so Paul, this is why this is going to be a brilliant podcast. this is it right there. I mean, I'll come to you first, Paul. So, footballers, I mean, I have no frame of reference, but it, you know, it's an incredibly demanding career, you know, high pressure. You know, it doesn't matter what area you're playing in, that, you know, the demand must always have been there. But I suppose someone like Gary to have to deal not only with trying to make your way as a professional in what is an incredibly difficult environment, career and job to do, but then to have this medical condition and be told by 3 different doctors that this is it, this is the end. You wonder how young people can recover from such a situation.
Yeah, I mean, I know when you first diagnosed, Gary, that you were put in contact with Danny McGrain, is that correct? Because he'd come down with diabetes playing for Scotland in the World Cup in 74?
Yes, Danny was coming towards the end of his career. And then after the World Cup, he was diagnosed with diabetes. So yes, I got in touch, or initially a friend of ours, we got in touch with Danny. He was quite a difficult person to try and get hold of, to be honest. But yes, and then obviously he said that he was, you know, he was able to continue after the World Cup. So I went back to my specialist, explained it all to him, and you know, he said, well, yeah, that's positive, Gary. But obviously, the thing is you're starting from the age of 17.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Danny's played in the World Cup finals. And you know, slightly different type, but he said no. And again, it was a, I think for any, for myself, I think we were looking to cling on to anything that was positive. Mm-hmm. And certainly, you know, Danny had, had proven that he could continue his career.
I think at the time as well, Gary, because the condition wasn't widely publicised, there weren't that many sportsmen who were known to have the condition. I'm sure a few had it, but didn't actually come out and make it public, because there was kind of a bit of a stigma about it to some extent in the 70s and 80s.
To be honest, Paul, I think there, you know, there maybe still be some stigma with people not wanting others to know about it, worried about would they lose an opportunity to get a job because of it. And when I was first diagnosed, they said that exactly thing, same thing to me. They said, look, Gary, do you want this to be made public? Because a lot of people don't. And obviously, I was in the public eye at the time. And suddenly, you know, when I went straight into hospital, I was playing in the first team of Bristol Rovers. So it was quite big news that I was being diagnosed when it came out. And I said, look, I'm very happy for it to become public. Got no reason to hide it. Just one of those things you have to deal with. And I think I was... Throughout my whole career, if I'm being totally honest, Paul, I've been lucky in that I've always had this attitude that, and all of us as human beings, we get setbacks all the time. Every time you turn a corner, there's another setback waiting for you. But I've tried to use every setback as a stepping stone to move forward. And I think being diagnosed with diabetic, being told that you would not be able to continue your career, that gave you even more impetus to make sure you could, and give yourself the best opportunity of doing that. I mean, it was different. I wasn't able to, I wasn't able to go out with the lads drinking. Wasn't able to do a lot of things that, after match they go out and they stay out late and go to a nightclub and have parties. I had to be home by sort of midnight. I'd have my bedtime injections. I never ever stopped me, being part of the team. And I was lucky enough to be captain at Spurs for 11 years. And whenever the team went out, I was always there with them. But I'd always be there drinking Diet Coke and leaving before midnight to get home. In the end, I probably became a bit of a captain and a father figure, because I was the one having to make sure they behaved themselves when they were out partying.
Did you find that frustrating at all, Gary?
No, because... I mean, of course, the lads, I got immense stick. You may imagine the lads, come on, come out, have a drink, have this, have that. And I was always like, I knew full well that if I went off the rails once, that could be the end of my career. Mm-hmm. I was told distinctly, definitely, that Gary, we doubt if you will make a career in football with the condition, but these are the regulations. Mm-hmm. If you want to, this has to be done. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't given much leeway, to be honest. And so, yes, I had a very... very regimented regime that I had to stick to as far as my diet, my eating, having to change everything around matches. Sometimes you kick off at 3 o'clock, sometimes at evening kickoff. So now it can be any day of the week, any time. And that was how it was.
Did you find you on your playing days then that were you having to take extra injections at half time? If a match went to extra time, were you coming off and getting an extra snack to keep you going? And I guess when you were first playing for Tottenham as well, blood glucose machines was just coming onto the market for the first time?
Yes. Initially, you're doing urine tests. So basically, you'd have a stick from a bottle, you take it, go into the bathroom, you'd wee on the stick, and then it would give you a reading, obviously the colour. Then it became blood monitoring machines. Glucose monitoring. So that became a lot easier. But no, I mean, my life, when the chaps all, every game, we come in there, we'd arrive at a stadium, I'd do a blood test when we arrived there. Depending on what the blood test was, I'd maybe have to have an injection or some extra glucose drink. Go out for a warm-up, come in, like literally 5 minutes before kickoff, I would do another blood test. And again, if I was a bit low, I'd have some glucose drink. If not, then if I was a bit high, I'd have some insulin. And same at half-time. I had a half-time injection during the cup final. It's something which... having diabetes, it's a condition you can live with, but it's a way of... You have to be strict with your days. You have to make sure that you know where you're going to be when you're going to have your next meal. Make sure that where you're going to be, there's going to be enough carbohydrates to cover the insulin you're injecting into yourself. It's all this monitoring. So... match days were always full of monitoring. Come off after a match, you do another blood test and adjust accordingly. But when I tell people, like, now I have to do 7 injections a day and 10 blood tests every day. So people, I tell that to people, they think, oh my goodness, that's unbelievable. But it's like brushing my teeth now. Yeah, I've been doing it for 42 years. It's something that I do. There are things that are coming in that make life easier for diabetics. But currently I'm still on the injections and pricking my finger to do blood tests.
Do you use the freestyle lever monitoring system at all then, Gary, or are you still pure on the finger pricking?
No, I'm still on finger pricking. There's a fantastic product that's come out called the Libra, and it basically it goes into your arm. There's a little patch on your arm, and on your mobile phone you have an app. You just put the phone onto your shoulder by the where it's connected, and it gives you your blood reading. So it's amazing. Families with youngsters who worry during the night maybe that their child may be going a bit low. If you go low, you have something called a hypo attack, hypoglycemic attack, where your blood sugars go too low, the brain gets starved of blood, and you start to behave like you're drunk to some degree. You're very vague. And if you don't have some sugar pretty quickly, then you can soon fall over, collapse, and go into a coma. So it's quite serious to make sure you don't have a hypo. So for parents who are concerned about their youngsters, all they've got to do at night now is go to the youngster, get the thing, put it on their arm, rather than normally they have to wake them up first, get the blood machine out, prick their fingers, get some blood out, wait for the reading, and then maybe adjust accordingly because of the reading, and it's in the middle of the night. So now they can do it with a Libra, which is a fantastic, fantastic new innovation that's coming in this last sort of couple of years. But unfortunately, this Libra is expensive and it's not yet available to everybody on the NHS. So there's been a lot of canvassing that's being done towards government. Obviously at the moment, you've got to be a bit careful because the COVID situation obviously has to take most control at the moment. And so you can't be too harassing at the moment trying to get things done. But still, when we get the opportunity, we keep canvassing government to make sure that we want to make the Libra available to every youngster in this country and everybody that needs it. It's slightly unfair in that because I'm Gary Mabbott, somebody would give me a machine free. And that's not correct. That's not right. There are people out there far more needy than me that obviously need the machine and can't afford it. So I made a statement saying that I was not going to use the Libra, and I keep doing my pricking my finger 10 times a day to get blood out to do my testing until it's available to every diabetic in the country on the NHS. So as I say, obviously mostly concerning at the moment is the pandemic, but hopefully as that starts to, hopefully next summertime when everyone's been vaccinated and it's all hopefully clearing out of the way, we can do a bit more work on trying to make these things happen.
Excellent, Gary, thank you.
I mean, Stephen, just listen, we're sat here listening to Gary talk. And the thing that strikes me is the parallel between Gary as a player and his influence on the pitch, demeanour on the pitch, character on the pitch, and then the way he's conducted himself with diabetes, research, development, adapting with innovation, adapting with change. They almost run parallel, with each other. Gary, the player, is also Gary, the campaigner, and what have you. They just seem to completely reflect each other.
Oh, completely. I mean, my father-in-law has diabetes, so everything that's been discussed there is epically familiar to me. The hypos, I've had to run to the shop to go and get an emergency pint of milk or a bar of chocolate on occasions and stuff like that. And I know just how almost military it has to be so organised and have everything in line. And to be able to do that on a day-to-day basis for the normal person in the street is huge. And to offset that with a football career as well, it's an utterly amazing, achievement, really. But within that, to take that on as well and to campaign, you know, it's an inspiring thing.
It's, I mean, obviously, you know, this is a combination, because obviously a lot of the work that you do, like we say with Diabetes UK, you know, and you've mentioned there about, you know, the access that you're given perhaps because of who you are and sort of the unfairness of all of that. And, you know, hopefully people that are listening here are sort of, I suppose, are, you know, want to listen to, you know, the stories of Gary Mabbutt, the footballer, but also the struggles, you know, of Gary Mabbutt, you know, the person who's suffering from diabetes. I can't relate to either, unfortunately, but hopefully there are people who are listening to this who will be able to relate to life as a professional footballer, but I imagine the majority of them will be able to relate to, you know, trying to lead life with, you know, with any sort of condition that can be debilitating. But in terms of, obviously, your Tottenham career, the diagnosis obviously never visibly seemed to impact on your performance, you know, the number of appearances, you know, and what you did was testimony to that. But the sort of two things that I want to ask you, because, you know, you win the UEFA Cup in 84 and the FA Cup in 91. So those two cup finals, and certainly the 84 one, seem to belong to a different era of the game. But you then have the Premier League in 92 and the game changes, and you're sort of one of those players who sits astride the sort of change in English football. Was it something that you noticed? So from that 84 UEFA Cup final to sort of, you know, regular Premier League appearances, did you notice the changes in the English game at the time?
As a player, no, I don't think so. I mean, as a player, players are quite stoical. They deal with things very, very well. And you get players, you'll miss, you know, you may miss half a season with an injury. And for players, what they have to go through to get back from an injury is immense. It all looks great on the outside, and my goodness, they're a professional footballer, and these players, they're, you know, they're superstars to the fans and the supporters, and they're all over these magazines and this newspaper every week. But it's a, you know, it can be a very tough life. You know, there are only 11 happy footballers at every club every week. None of the 11 are being picked for the next game. Everybody else is disappointed. Why am I being left out? What have I got to do to get into the team? I get into the team. Then suddenly 2 weeks later, I get an injury and keep me out for a month. The other person whose place I took comes back in and does well. You then got to fight for your place back. You know, it's a fantastically well-paid career, and it's an amazing career to have. Yeah, it's for me to have had 21 years playing professional football. You know, I was very lucky. I stopped playing football when I was just about, my last game for Spurs in the Premier League was just coming up 37 years of age. And up until that stage, I hadn't done a day's work in my life. Yeah, it's only since then I've had to actually do what the work. You know, and it's a fantastic life. But, you know, you're very much going from game to game. You know, we used to play like, you know, two games in 2 days over Easter and Christmas. And you move into the Premier League and, yes, there are more games on television. There's more money in the game. There are more changes. But the actual playing side of it, it's exactly the same. People talk about, you know, they always mention to me, look, could, you know, what would Stanley Matthews have been like if he was playing today? If Stanley Matthews had been playing today, he'd be like a Lionel Messi, because he'd have had all the advantages of the coaching, the training, how players are today, and he's got that quality. So he'd been brought up in that era. Every player of that era that they are in, they would have been able to play in any era where all the things were different at the time. There were times when we turn up for a match, you know, 3 hours before kickoff to have our pre-match lunch. I mean, things all change at clubs now. Everything will be done differently. We used to travel all the time on the coach to go up to say, we're playing Liverpool at the weekend. We'd travel up on a Friday. It used to take about 6 hours from London to Liverpool on a Friday, the traffic. You get there and obviously travel back after the game. Played at Notts Forest one day where the game was abandoned because of snow. We had to get back to London on a coach in the snow, and it took us forever. You know, there are a lot of things that go on behind the scenes that you know, people don't actually realise. And you know, for myself, I had to be extra sort of, I suppose, focused because of my condition. But no, as I say, it's the most wonderful career to have, but there's a lot of competition. I mean, in training, as I said, there's 11 happy players. There's a lot of unhappy players. And there's a lot of tackles that go in training. Probably every other week in training, there'll be a fight in training where, you know, there'll be a scuffle would happen between a couple of players because been, someone's gone in too hard or whatever, or said something. You know, it's, you're there to earn your place in the team. Once you earn that place in the team, that's where it's harder. It's not hard to get into the team. It's hard to get in the team, but once you get there, you've got to stay there. And it means every single week, you always talk about, it's a cliche, you're only as good as your last game. That's absolutely true in football. You'll be judged on your last game. If you play two or three very good games before that, you may get the benefit of the doubt. But sooner or later, if you play two or three bad games in a row, you've got the media on top of you, you've got the club on top of you, the manager on top of you, the fans on top of you. And then the next game, you know full well, if you make a mistake again, you know, you're going to be hammered. So yes, it's a lot of discipline, a lot of focus. But I say that's why professional footballers are where they are, because they're able to, they've got the abilities and they have the, I suppose, the mental strength and the discipline to be able to attain to what they have and to be able to remain there. And, you know, it's a tough mentality to have to get through professional football. There's a lot of players who I've seen in my whole career who've had far more ability than me and should have been top players. But the expectations when they go to a big club, the, you know, the way the fans, what they're expecting from you is far greater. The pressures put upon you are far greater. And it's even greater when you play for your country. So, you know, all these things players have to be able to deal with. And that's all part of the structure of being a professional sportsman, no matter what sport it is. So, let's say, it's the most wonderful, wonderful life that I led for those 21 years. If I'd have been a youngster and someone had told me I'd have played for one of the top clubs in the world for 16 years, I'd have been the, you know, one of the longest serving captains for 11 years and played 619 games for that club in all competitions, I would never believe them. So yes, as I said, it was, I regard myself as being very, very fortunate to have done what I did.
I mean, Paul, you know, one sort of name that sort of unifies, if you and Gary are going to have something in common, and I found a thread, don't worry. you know, you're an Everton fan. Obviously, Gary was at Tottenham, you know, Gazza. You know, Gazza's the unifying factor here between the two of you. And I guess, obviously, you maybe didn't see the best of Gazza, Paul at Everton. But Gary maybe saw the best of him at Tottenham.
Yeah, I mean, I think the version Gascoigne we got, I think we've been sold and dubbed by that stage, I think. And it's interesting comparing the lifestyle issue there, isn't it? Because I know Gaz has had his issues and they've definitely impacted upon his playing career compared to the career that Gary had there. But Gary, what was he like in your squad? What was he like in training? Well, you mentioned the nights out. I can't imagine he sat quietly in the corner.
No, I mean, I was the club captain at the time. I remember being on holiday. I think I was in Portobanus in Spain, walking around the harbour there with my girlfriend. I walked past one of these, one of the shops selling newspapers. And I saw like the front or back page, you know, Gazza signs for Spurs. And I just went, oh my goodness. because I knew all about him as a player, but also about him as a character. And he was true to life. He was full of nonsense, but I've got to say that he's one of the best footballers I've ever had the privilege of playing with. People always ask me about my Spurs days and who was the best player I played with at Spurs. I was lucky to play with so many players there. Obviously from Ray Clements, rest in peace, Clem, who passed away last week, unfortunately. But Steve Perriman, Glenn Hoddles, Ozzy Ardiles, Ricky Villa, then going through, I played with the likes of Chrissy Waddle, Gary Lineker, Teddy Sheringham, Jurgen Klinsmann, David Ginola. Yeah, I played with some great, great players. But for me, I would say that I cannot choose between Glenn Hoddle and Paul Gascoigne. Glenn's range of passing, I've never seen any other player in the world have that ability that he has. My first season at Spurs, and you'll probably be quite surprised at this, chaps, is that I was the joint top goal scorer with Steve Archibald. I was playing in midfield at the time. I was like a box-to-box midfielder. So it's like myself at Spurs, you had like Brian Robson at United, you had John Walker at Ipswich, Souness at Liverpool. And so, yes, so defended when we went forward, got in the box. And my first season there, I scored 12 goals. And I think everyone, I made a run in the box, and Glenn Hoddle put it either on my head or on my foot. So I think my only goal for England, again, came from a Glenn Hoddle corner. So we had a good understanding, but you know, you made a run and make it clear where you wanted the ball, he would put it there for you. Gazza could. We could be playing in a game, away from home, deep mud, middle of winter, do not deserve to win the game, and he would grab the game by the scruff of the neck and turn it your way. His qualities, his abilities, you know. But again, that some people who have that, you know, that extra, that maestro's qualities, those geniuses, you know, they have a bit of a nonsense about them. And, you know, Paul certainly did. Most of the stories that happened, I can't really tell. but obviously, Paul and I became, you know, obviously looked after him, became very close during his time at Spurs. I can remember our first away game. I think we're playing Man City, I think. And so anyway, Gazza's first game for the club away from home. So you play the game. After the match, you have a shower, go into the players' lounge, have a drink with the opponents, and then you get in the coach and go home. Now, us pampered soccer stars, we have a beautiful team coach. We have two chefs on the coach who cook us a four-course meal on the way home with a glass of wine if we win. All very nice. So being a diabetic, I have to inject myself before every meal. So after matches, rather than going to the players' lounge for a drink, I went straight onto the coach to do my injection, ready for the meal. So I'm halfway down the coach, sitting in a chair by a table. I've got my needle out, I've got my insulin out, and I'm just pulling the insulin into my needle, and I see Gazza getting on the bus. And he's clocking me the whole way, and he stops by the table. He's gone, "Mamsie, what are you doing?" I said, "Well, Paul, I'm a diabetic. You know, I have sugar diabetes." You know, I didn't even try to explain to him what diabetes was. I think he thought it was a boxer or something, you know. So I said, "No, I have sugar diabetes. And I have to inject myself four times every day." He went, "Just while you're a footballer." I said, "No, I inject myself four times every day for the rest of my life." He went, "Four times every day for the rest of your life?" I went, "Yes." "Cool," he said. "But you can't wait to die, can you?" I looked up and there was that Gazza grin. So, you know, he was a great character to have around. You know, his abilities on the field. I mean, that year, 1990-1991, I think that was his best year of his whole career. He virtually got us to the FA Cup final single-handedly that year. You can't do it on your own, but virtually his abilities, the goals, the assists, and obviously, you know, he had this serious injury after that, and I don't think he ever got back to the level that he was then. If he hadn't have got that injury, who knows what he could have achieved in those next, or even more he could achieve in the next few years. So, yeah, I mean, Gazza was great. Crikey, we could be here for all day talking about stories. The trouble is, you have gone to an X-rated podcast, I'm afraid. But no, I mean, obviously, it's been well documented about Paul's struggles since his playing days. And obviously, we still keep in touch. So I was in touch in the last couple of days. So we keep in touch every sort of week or two. And he's doing okay, so that's good. A good thing.
Good, glad to hear that, Gary. Glad to hear that.
Steve and I, you know, I'll come to you. Obviously, you know, Gary, not so much a one club man, but certainly arguably as close as you're going to get, apart from someone like Ryan Giggs. But obviously, you know, you're a Liverpool fan, and you know, and there was a time, I guess, when your club were interested in Mr. Mabbott.
Yeah, so well, remember. At the time, we signed John Barnes and Peter Beardsley, and Gary's name popped up as a potential signing as well. And I remember being as delighted about that as I was about Barnes and Beardsley. And I think Gary would have just suited that Liverpool side, especially that post 87 side, because we played a style of football at the time prior to Barnes and Beardsley arriving that had two wide midfielders tucked in rather than wingers, and the fullbacks used to bomb on, and a lot of the football was played centrally. But the introduction of Barnes and Ray Houghton, it stretched the game across the pitch, yeah, Gary would have been absolutely perfect to that side, and it would have been a well-timed purchase had it happened, because we lost Mark Lawrenson the following January. Gary Gillespie started to have significant injury problems from the summer of 88 onwards, and then obviously Alan Hansen's knees kicked in. Of all the ones that got away throughout the 80s, there's three players in particular that I always lamented. One was Michael Laudrup, who we dropped the ball on in 83. Gary was another around 87, 88. And the other was Anders Limpar, who we had on trial for a week's trial around about 88-ish. Because we had such a strength in depth at the time, it never happened. So when he came back and tormented us in an Arsenal shirt, I always remember lamenting that. But yeah, Gary would have been absolutely perfect to the Liverpool side. And because he played on for so long as well, what we lost was that concept of the baton being handed over. So from Ron Yates all the way through to Alan Hansen, there was always a progression from one central defender to the next generation. So you had the likes of Ron Yates that helped out the Amlin Hughes and the likes of Larry Lloyd through. Then there would be an overlap to Phil Thompson, Alan Hansen, and it was a progression. And then suddenly that stopped. Whereas Gary, who managed to play into the late 1990s, would have been that perfect next player to hand the baton on to, who could have taught the next generation. But instead, we ended up with Torben Pitnick and some absolute shockers.
I mean, were you ever tempted, Gary? And, you know, I mean, obviously your career at Tottenham, you know, clearly your love for the club is, you know, it's evident in everything that you say and do. But was there a temptation to maybe move?
Yes, there was a temptation, purely because as a footballer, you know, obviously growing up in the game, you know, following it my whole life, Liverpool were at that stage in world football, Liverpool were probably the best. They dominated the English game and European game during this period of time, and I'd had 5 years at Spurs. My contract was up, and so the day after my last game of that season, I got phone calls from Kenny Dalglish at Liverpool, Sir Alex Ferguson at Manchester United, George Graham at Arsenal, and then Atletico Madrid in Spain and Lyon in France. So I mean, you know, I had the opportunity, so I thought, well, I spoke to all the clubs. I dismissed George Graham pretty quickly, but it was a bit of a sneaky one, because we both had the same lawyer, and after the last game of the season, our lawyer decided to have a barbecue at his house and invited me and George Graham, which I didn't know about. And of course, at the party, you know, George tried to get me to convince me to move over to Arsenal, which was you know, obviously Arsenal, fantastic you know, club for their supporters and players, but it wasn't for me after being at Spurs. So Manchester United, again, Sir Alex Ferguson, a fantastic manager. But this is just prior to the era they sort of took over the domination of English football. And then it was Liverpool. And in the end, would only have ever been, if I'd have left, would be going to Liverpool. I spoke to Kenny numerous times. And he said to me, you know, categorically, Gary, I want to sign three players this year. I want to sign you, Peter Beardsley and John Barnes. He told me where he wanted me to play. He was offered to double my salary that I was earning at Tottenham. So everything was very positive, where he wanted me to play. He knew where I'd fit in. And so, yes, I mean, I thought about it. But then, yeah, overall, I think that I had five wonderful years at Spurs. We just had a fantastic year in 87 where we came, I think it was third in the league, semi-final of the League Cup, final of the FA Cup. It was the almost but not quite season for Spurs. And I don't know what it is, but say my first game for Spurs, we were back in 1982. We were at home to Luton in the first division, and full crowd, full stadium, sunny day, beautiful first game of the season. And I was in the side to start. And you can imagine the fans, normally they're used to the big money signings coming in, the £1 million players coming in from, you know, all the big clubs. And there was this person called Gary Mabbott from Bristol Rovers who was starting the first game of the season, and no one had a clue who I was. And then literally within the first 5 minutes we got a free kick. Glenn Hoddle took the free kick, I made the run in the box and I scored. And from that moment, literally to this day, 38 years later, my relationship with the Spurs fans has been absolutely incredible. It's a very, everyone involved in football with your own club, you're very passionate about your own club. I think that was one of the reasons why I didn't leave in the end to join Liverpool. I was enjoying my football at Spurs. I thought we could go on to achieve things at Spurs. We just had a great season. We could build on that and move forward. So I phoned up Kenny, and Kenny was fantastic. He said, "Look, Gary, I totally understand, but obviously, that's your decision." And in fact, Kenny and I became, the time and playing against each other over the years, we became friends. And Kenny, in fact, appeared on my "This Is Your Life" program as a guest, basically coming on just to say that I was the only player he wanted to sign who didn't sign for him.
And little did you know it upset Stephen as well.
Upset me as well. Yeah.
Exactly.
Joined one of the three in that company of Michael Laudrup and Anders Limpar. There's a couple of things, Gary. I was chatting about, with regards to the current situation with COVID and the things you're doing with the club. But I guess just before that, though, you mentioned Ray Clements and his passing. Obviously, Paul, although you're an Everton fan, you'll appreciate, how great a goalkeeper Ray Clements was. And the other one is Maradona and the testimonial for Ozzy Ardiles. Did you play in that game?
Did I play in that game, did you ask? Craig,
yeah.
I thought you'd done the internet search. You'd have found a great picture of me standing alongside Diego Maradona in the lineup. We had a four-man midfield that day.
Because I was about to say that, but I didn't want to get it wrong and offend you by being someone else.
We had a four-man midfield that day. Would you believe it? It was myself, and alongside me, I had Ozzy Ardiles, Glenn Hoddle, and Diego Maradona. So, not a bad midfield to be part of. It was fantastic. Obviously, I'm very close to Ozzy Ardiles. Ozzy and Diego were best of friends. Diego came over to play in his testimonial for him. He came over a number of other times to stay with Ozzy. So I met him other times as well. Again, for me, Pelé and Maradona, everyone talks about. And again, now this era, it'd be the youngster, it'd be Messi, Ronaldo. But I think probably for, again, this is a very weird and I'm totally diversifying from the question, but I played alongside Maradona in that game. Okay, a few years later, and probably about 8-9 years ago, I was selected for a FIFA World 11 to play in Nelson Mandela's 90th birthday celebrations in Cape Town. So we're playing against an African 11. So the African 11 had been like Samuel Eto'o, and we had great stars playing for the African 11. In our side, we had Zubi Zaretta, Butragueño, Ruud Gullit. We had Christian Carambo, and we had a certain player up front called Pelé. So obviously, being in a dressing room and alongside Pelé was actually quite a nice experience. And also, we played in 1984, we won the UEFA Cup. And on the way to win the UEFA Cup, we played Feyenoord during the competition. And they had a player called, one of the world's great, Johan Cruyff. He was coming toward the end of his career, but I was given, the game was billed as a Johan Cruyff v Glenn Hoddle game. And I was given the role of man-marking Johan Cruyff. And we won the game. We were 4-0 up at half-time. Glenn absolutely destroyed them with his passing and everything. So it was a fantastic game. But why I get into a very strange point and being how football is so weird, and I grew up being a lover of football. And I had two tortoises, okay, when I was about 7-8 years of age. My tortoises, one was called Pelé and one was called Cruyff. So, how your years of growing up, how they stay with you. And for me, still, Pelé, and of course, then Maradona came along, Cruyff in there as well. They're the players of that time for me. And playing alongside Diego, say, it was a fantastic experience. And Clem. Well, I arrived at Spurs and Ray Clemens was a goalkeeper. I was this Mr. Nobody from Bristol Rovers, 20 years of age. I was staying at a hotel called the Ponsbourne Hotel. It's not far from the training ground on my own. And in the first week I was there, obviously Ray knew this. And Ray, after training one day, invited me around to his house. Went around to his house and met V, his wife. For me to be taken by Ray Clemens, who I watched all the time playing for England, for Liverpool, and had honored, you know, been admired all the time, and been so in awe of what he was doing for England as well as Liverpool. And then for him to do that, I thought was, you know, was fantastic. He didn't have to do it, but it certainly made me feel good. But Ray was a tough keeper to play. Ray set high standards for himself, not only himself, but everyone around him. And, you know, if you made a mistake, you'd know about it. He was one of the most vocal goalkeepers that I've ever heard in the game. He really gave me, you know, my sort of further education in professional football, I think, came from Clem. And I learned a heck of a lot from him.
Paul, I'm really struggling to find a link between you, Cruyff, Pelé and Maradona. I'm done.
Must have had a cat or something called. Yeah.
I'm really sorry, Paul. I'm out with links there. But I guess
if you threw Pelé in as well, I could say I have seen them all.
Oh, well, there you go.
You know, I saw Pelé at Goodison in 66. So, yeah, you know, it works.
but I suppose, you know, Paul, this is, you know, so some players, you know, and obviously guys on there, but I want to say some players get their just deserts in their career, and Gary's probably one of those. You know, some of it is playing experience, some of it is medals, some of it is career longevity, some of it is staying injury-free, whatever it is. But, you know, sort of listening to Gary there and the players that he's played with and, you know, winning the UEFA Cup, FA Cup, the longevity of the career, you know, and being such a, it sounds odd, such a nice guy, but being, you know, a true ambassador of the sport, you know, it just sometimes good things happen to good people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, of all the footballers I've kind of grown up with, me and Gary's the one who's always impressed me with the way he's conducted himself, both on the pitch and off the pitch, and in his post-football career as an ambassador for so many different causes, and particularly his campaign and work for Diabetes UK. And you can't underestimate as well that, you know, when he used to work in education, and sometimes you'd have parents coming in wanting a meeting with you to say their son or daughter have just come down with diabetes, you know, they're age 12, 13, 14. And you can see that the family were really, really down about it and struggling to know how to deal with it. And once I started to talk to me about Gary Mabbas, you've heard of Gary Mabbas? Oh, the footballer, he's diabetic. Is he? I didn't know that. Yeah, he's had it since he was like a teenager like you. And it just worked as well, you know. I just say to him, read his book, Against All Odds, have a look at how he's dealt with the condition, because the condition doesn't stop you going on to what you want to achieve in life. And just, you know, bringing Gary into the conversation, you could just see people's whole demeanour changing during the course of the conversation, where they came in almost on the floor and they came out thinking, yeah, you know, I can beat this. And nothing used to give me greater pride than to watch either a boy or a girl playing sport for the school who'd recently been diagnosed with diabetes and thinking, that is brilliant. That is the message you want to send out there. And I don't think you can underestimate, Gary, how much your influence had on those people coming through, because once your name was mentioned, the barriers came down and they could see there was a path for them. And it's, as you know, from the work that you do, particularly now, you know, with all your commitments to, you know, the vulnerable Spurs fans, etc., it's hope that keeps people going. And if you can give people hope, that's the thing that inspires them to engage with life positively.
No, thanks, Paul. I mean, the thing is that, yeah, we're all individual people. We're all ourselves. I like to think that I'm the same person I am now than I was when I left school and started my apprenticeship. You know, I was so lucky. I had a most amazing career. You know, I'm lucky that I sort of got fantastic, you know, love and respect from me to them, to a lot of football supporters. And you know, I think that was what I, you know, for me, just being yourself, doing what you feel is right to do. And as I say, I've been very fortunate, been able to lead a wonderful life so far, being involved as a player, and then since being a player, involved in the work that I do with the club. I'm on the FA disciplinary committee, and I've had sort of other offers to go into sort of a director of football roles or advisory roles within the game. And it's very nice to get that still. You know, you have a career, and you know, I think some of what you did during your career does rub off on people. Think, well, actually, he may be a position this may be worth you know, talking to Gary about. So yeah, I mean, as I said, most importantly, I've been absolutely privileged to be a professional footballer for the time that I was. You know, the love that I've got from, you know, from the game, I think has been amazing for myself, considering that as a youngster, you want to be a professional footballer, you want to do the best that you possibly can. As I said before, everyone that's listening, every diabetic that I talk to, I tell them that diabetes will not stop them doing anything they want to do, but always to aim high. Aim, whatever you do, aim high. And if you'll get far higher than you would have done if you aim low. So, yeah, when I was growing up, I used to watch every football game on TV, used to watch every competition. And, as a boy, you dream of, playing at the highest level. We used to watch the FA Cup every single year as a family. It was like a special family day. It would be like, it started at 9 a.m. The only game shown live on TV the whole year. And you'd be like, it's a cup final knockout and breakfast with the teams and how the teams got there. On the coach with the teams. Yeah, we used to watch it the whole day until the captain lifted the FA Cup. And the thing that I've been one of those captains that's actually done that. But again, you always have your dreams. My initial total dream would have been, of course, to have lifted the World Cup. Bobby Moore was my hero when I was growing up. He lifted the trophy for England. But of course, that wasn't possible during my career and it didn't happen. But you said I was... What I did, I'm very proud of, and as I said, I feel very privileged. I was able to be given the opportunity.
Stephen, last thing I guess before, unfortunately we have to let Gary go, otherwise I'd keep him here all day. but it's this is one. It's the power that football has, and we talk about it a lot on the podcast. About the sort of the social influence that football can have, the impact that footballers can have either during the career or post-career. But you look at the impact Gary had as a player, and then you look at the impact now, like we say, on Diabetes UK, on the Tottenham fans during these sort of unprecedented times. And it just goes to show the power that football can have for good, as much as it sometimes gets bad press. But the power it has for good is demonstrated right here.
Yeah, push comes to shove, it's a microcosm of everyday life. All sorts of personalities, they'll end up in a football shirt, and some for power of good, some will be selfish. It's no different to kind of like any other work environment or social environment or community. Sometimes it might be almost like a cartoon version of that, and because it's under such a microscope. But yes, it's such a thing of it's that we always come back to the word impressionable, and it's that impression that someone can leave behind. And for someone in the public eye to be able to do that has, an even greater, impact. I think, for any of us to go out there and make a difference to someone, I always try and, if I can help someone, I always try and help someone, in the hope that, maybe they'll go out and help two or three people themselves. And you can make a difference just by helping someone do something simple. Yet, Gary, in such an impressionable arena, has managed to do this tenfold. And it's talking about the cup final day there, and me and you, Stu, we've come back to it time and time again and said it's that sense of occasion. And, these people who have gone out there and done that, and how special it looks. It almost looks like a wedding day in a footballing format. It's that brilliance of it all. And Gary's right. It's that sense of, breakfast with the players. And I can always remember the 83 Cup final where Man United players were disturbed. They were in bed and a camera came bursting through the door and stuff like that. And it's these things that are somehow lost to a new generation. But it all puts it out there into the public consciousness. And for Gary to come along and carry on his brilliant work as a sports person, but to carry that on into his work with diabetes and Diabetes UK, and just to spread the word of a fantastic cause, but also within his demeanour, and to be able to put that across in such a brilliant way, it's an amazing thing.
Gary, obviously we have to let you go. But I suppose one final question. You are an incredibly busy man, incredibly busy. What are the current things that you're working on? Where are your passions at the moment? What's your main drive and your main goal at the moment?
The main goal at the moment is to get back into stadiums would be one. That would be a great thing to do. we're not quite sure whether or not we'll be allowed back in at the moment. It will change on a daily basis, so we're not sure about when we'll get to the next game. But for myself, I'm still spending 2 or 3 hours a day on the phone, calling all fans who, as you mentioned before, special occasions. I spoke to a 99-year-old gentleman recently as well. And most of them are in good spirits, which is great. You get the occasional ones that aren't doing so well and lonely, and it's great to have a chat to them. And we do have, with the Tottenham Hotspur Foundation, we have healthcare experts that can assist people if they need assisting. So that's always there as well. So it's been quite worthwhile to do that. Also, I've got a great love of a lot of other things in life. I love the wildlife, photography of wildlife. So my wife is South African, so we spend a lot of time in the Kruger Park in South Africa. So I've done a lot of work with some companies over there trying to deal with the poaching situations of elephants and now mainly rhino. So we've been able to invest some money in some groups who are actually protecting the animals within the Kruger Park. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things I enjoy doing. But of course, my life has been based around football. And even when I go to the Kruger Park, I was there 4 or 5 years ago. And I've gone to drive around the Kruger Park. And I've stopped at a dam in the Kruger Park and watching the water holes if animals come to drink. And other cars are put up alongside me. And I sort of, sitting in the car, the window down, guy's put up beside me. And he's turned to me and said, "Are you Gary Mabbutt?" And I was like, sitting in the middle of the Kruger Park, and it was like places in the world. It's like the Kruger's the size of Wales. It's like massive. It's totally open. And there's somebody there who just turned to you and recognised who you were purely because you were able to play professional football. And that, we had a great conversation. But I just thought, amazing how I'm sitting here and somebody has actually recognised me. But no, I mean, I spend quite a bit of time in the Kruger Park where I get the opportunity. So yes, there are a lot of things that interest me in life. And as I mentioned before, football has been, has been my life. And Spurs has been part of my family for the last 38 years. So, I'm sure hopefully that will last for a while longer.
Brilliant. Paul, I'll hand over to you. Obviously, you've arranged this podcast. You've managed to give me the best Saturday I've had in months, if not years. enjoyed yourself?
It's been fabulous. I keep going back to the old quote that it's always a danger to meet your heroes, because sometimes, they don't live up to your expectations. I could just say from a personal point of view, I like Gary, I'm a type 1 diabetic. I was diagnosed the year after Gary in 1979. And all the time throughout my life, Gary's been an absolute inspiration and role model to me. And, I've been a member of Diabetes UK for the same length of time as well. And everything I've done, everything I've coped with in my life, I've always looked to Gary for inspiration. So sorry to put that on you, Gary, but it's just been fascinating. It's just been fascinating listening to you. And what I said before about using you as an example when I met children who've been diagnosed with diabetes is totally true. And the work that you're still doing and the campaign and work you're doing for Diabetes UK, particularly your campaign to get the Freestyle Libre available to everyone across the country, because it's outrageous that some people are paying £100 a month to get the supplies when in other parts of the country that they're not. It just shows you've got the zest, you're still campaigning, you still believe in the cause. And for me, this has probably been one of the best hours of my life. Thank you so much.
Well, Paul's been a player. I can't believe you left it to the last second to return your type 1 diabetes. And you're looking really well, Paul. So you're obviously doing well with it.
No, thanks, Gary. It's like you say, and Steve mentions father-in-law as well. And I think sometimes type 1 diabetes goes under the radar a bit at the moment compared to type 2. And it's a condition you can manage. It's a condition you have to stick to certain rules and guidance. But I wouldn't have made it this far without you. So thank you so much.
Well, that's a real pleasure. And look after yourself.
Yes, thanks, Gary.
Obviously, all that's left for me to say is, like I say, I still have no link to Gary or Paul. I've still got nothing other than this conversation. Stephen, I imagine you're just still a little bit fed up that you didn't sign Laudrup, Gary and Andrew Limpar, but that's okay. But enjoyed your last hour?
Oh, it's been brilliant. And Gary, you've been a wonderful guest, and thank you for giving us your time.
No, cheers, guys. It's been an absolute pleasure. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary. Thank you.
all that's left for me to say is thank you to the listeners. I'm definitely not promising we'll have a guest of this calibre next time, so there's no problem trying. But still, please join us again now on the Lob podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.